Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm scared, fearful. You know why? That red circus out there. I'm beginning to enjoy it.
What is this, Bunny Week?
Look, any longer out on that road and I'm one of them, you know? A terminal crazy. Only I got a bronze badge to say I'm one of the good guys. You know what I'm trying to say?
That's a clip from George Miller's Outback indie film, Mad Max, starring a then-unknown Mel Gibson. Little did we know then that Miller's take on Australia's car culture and wasteland would become one of cinema's most enduring franchises. Ian Nathan is one of the United Kingdom's leading film writers, and he's a member of the Beta Three Timers Club. He has given us insights into the work of Christopher Nolan, Guillermo del Toro, and Ridley Scott. Ian returns today for the fourth time to discuss his latest book, The Legend of Mad Max, the complete saga from Mad Max to Furiosa. It's a gorgeous and comprehensive look behind the scenes of Miller's five high-octane films. Fun fact, the original Mad Max held the Guinness Book of World Records for the most profitable film ever made, until the Blair Witch Project beat it. Here's another fun fact. Did you know that Mad Max Fury Road was nominated for 10 Academy Awards and won 6 of them? Ian has left no dangerous desert highways untraveled in writing this. He joins us now to talk about the creation, production, and legacy of the Mad Max cinematic universe, and why Miller's name should be held in the same regard as auteurs like Kurosawa, Spielberg, Buster Keaton, and my fellow Canadian, James Cameron.
Actually, when you watch the films, and you saw certainly number 2 and number 4, although I like them all, are just a kind of pitch of cinema where, and this is intentional from Miller's point of view, they are almost silent cinema. You know, he almost wants to withdraw all the dialogue, all the exposition, and just say, well, I want to do it like Keaton does it. I want that kind of pure kinetic force that comes with great filmmaking. And the possibility of action filmmaking. I mean, historically, you know, he was a doctor and he was hugely into film. And once you become a filmmaker, it's just kind of concertinaing his life somewhat. But he went into a film one day and he came out and he was talking to his friends. And he says, why is it when we talk to each other after a movie, we always talk about the best bits? We always go, oh, that bit and that bit. He said, why can't you build a film entirely out of the best bits? You know, why can't you purely have a film made of best bits? And that's kind of the origin of Mad Max, that he wanted it to be at a pitch of kind of fury and excitement, where he called it visual rock and roll, but it's a kind of symphonic power.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love that phrase, visual rock and roll. Yeah. I was really taken by that. That's such a great phrase. You say that no one else besides George Miller could have made the Mad Max film. So what is it that he brings to the table that nobody else could?
I suppose fundamentally, these are very Australian films. They're hugely popular, and obviously now they're backed by big American studios, but they are essentially Australian films, and that requires an essentially Australian filmmaker. And I think what is wonderful about the Mad Max films is often their strangeness. You know, although they're kind of very cool, very exciting, they're very strange. It's a mad world that Miller portrays. I think it's a very particular Australian sense of humour in the language. It kind of reflects a kind of mix of the Aboriginal dialects mixed with the kind of early Australian, almost the convict kind of way of going about this kind of hybrid language that came out. And it's mixed with an Australian sense of humour. It's very influenced by Australian car culture of the 60s and 70s, where they, you know, there's a good deal of anarchy literally on the roads of Australia. You know, also the landscape of all the films, you know, this kind of great barren desert backdrop is an essentially a kind of depiction of Australia. In a sense, the further forward the Mad Max films go in time, the further back it looks, you know, it more and more looks like the ancient, you know, kind of Australia. And I think Miller has recently said, he's going more to a sort of a medieval setup now. The more he appears into the future, the more atavistic, the more kind of deconstructed the human society is. And I think that's fundamentally born out of his Australianness. It's something, and I think they can only be shot really through an Australian lens. I know Number Four is made in Namibia, but all the others are Australian landscapes. So there's essentially an Australianness to it. But fundamentally, I think it's that the oddity of them and that kind of sense of humor that they have is very Australian.
Mm-hmm. Very well said. And I want to pick up a follow-up on something you mentioned, car culture. Miller has said that all Americans have gun culture and we Aussies have a car culture. What does he mean by that? And did it shape the making of the Mad Max movies?
It shaped Mad Max movies very much. Miller grew up in an isolated sort of backwater Australian town, one cinema, one restaurant. Kind of almost an archetypal idea of what remote Australia is like, 200 miles from Brisbane, I think, by railway. You're cut off from the world. And I think a lot of how teens of his generation, so you're talking 50s and 60s, got their kicks from putting together these kind of jalopy cars and kind of running them to a level where it was very dangerous. He said he lost friends in car accidents. And he said that was culturally how you grew up in Australia.
Should have been last of
the V8. Shut the gate on this one, Maxie. It's the duck's guts.
Yeah, she's the last of the V8. She sucks nitro. Face, forehead, twin overhead.
Tell him about the blower, yeah?
600 horsepower through the wheel. With the blower.
With the blower.
Oh, she's meanest, but the music and the bitch is born to love.
He's in a
coma,
man! And it was a violent culture. And that kind of idea that young nations, in America maybe too, are still kind of going through a sense of birth pang and, you know, finding out who they are. And they're two very similar nations in terms of their relationship with their landscapes that the nations were formed out of. I think that is kind of behind the car culture as well. There's a whole series of Australian films made in the 70s, which were a kind of car exploitation genre, made very cheaply, rather like Roger Corman films, that followed up on car culture and used it. And you draw back finally onto Miller himself, that he was a doctor. He trained as a doctor. He was an active doctor. And he saw the victims of car accidents on a nightly basis. And in a kind of strange, bleakly ironic way, that drew him, when he became a filmmaker, to Mad Max, to an exploration of violence that would lead to death.
He loses seat, goes through the windscreen, head first straight into the tree, right? And then bounces back through the windscreen. Now, by the time we got to him, he was just sitting there trying to scream with his face ripped off.
Yeah, he says, he's admitted, I know it's weird, but it's a kind of catharsis. You know, he had to figure out why is it doctors, himself included, could greet so much death and then be able to go home and sleep at night. How could he do that? How do they do that? And why is that capable? And in a sense, his answer to that is the Mad Max films. It's a kind of about human nature and human survival and how we confront death. And I think all those things kind of together with a kind of was the wellspring for Mad Max.
Mm-hmm. It sounds funny in hindsight, but Miller cast Mel Gibson because he wanted someone unrecognizable and or cheap. How did Gibson's portrayal of Max impact the series?
Fundamentally, yeah, it was absolutely vital. It was a really tough bit of casting. As you say, he had no money. So it wasn't like they could afford names, you know, named Australian actors. They really didn't have the money to do that. And they were unknown. So they really were just picking low-hanging fruit in terms of available actors. They got them from other exploitation films, but they couldn't find Max. And, you know, Miller is very instinctual and often, I think, fails to fully express what it is he's after. And I think sometimes that's why actors struggle with him a bit, because it's all going on in his head and he knows it when it happens and he knows it when he sees it. And he was at the end of his tether and he then, a friend said, look, there's these two guys at the Sydney Acting School that he should see. And one was Steve Bisley, who would later play the Goose character, Max's best friend. And the other one was Gibson. And And Gibson just walked in and sat down in front of the camera. They were recording the audition sessions. And Miller said he knew. He was mesmerized. The camera just loved him. You look through the lens and he forgot the questions he was going to ask. He forgot to do the audition properly because he said there was just a presence in the room that said it was Max.
2 days ago, I saw a vehicle that had hauled that tanker. Do you want to get out of here? You talk to me.
What it is, and I think Hardy has some of this too, is that there's an unknowability to Gibson. There's something remote about him that, and he never gives it to you. And that may make him not so good for other kinds of roles, you know, more intimate roles. But for this kind of thing, it was absolutely perfect. And he has so little dialogue. And there's no backstory really beyond the, he goes mad because his family are massacred. He's kind of, in many ways, an archetype rather than a character. Huh. Yet there's a presence that Gibson brings that you can't take your eyes off. And that's what Miller saw when he walked in the room.
Right. And mesmerizing, that's the key word. I think you picked the perfect word to discuss that. Yeah. Mad Max Fury Road is far and away the most successful film in the franchise. You say it became the metaphor of its own making. What do you mean by that?
I think this kind of applies to all of them, but especially Fury Road, in that every one of the Mad Max films was a nightmare to make. They are tremendously hard films to make. They are made in conditions that are grueling. Yeah, they are deserts. They are hot. I mean, on Mad Max 3, on Beyond Thunderdome, it got so hot that the metal in the costumes would burn skin. It would just, you know, really kind of unbelievable levels of heat. So they are grueling films. And I think, as most people know now, on Fury Road, there was tension between the two lead actors, Charlize Theron and Tom Hardy. There was, I think, tensions between the studio and Miller. And I think Miller had trouble with the film and the scale he was shooting on, communicating to people what the film was. I think one of Hardy's great problems that he had was that he just didn't understand where they were going to get. They were shooting, you know, you could spend 5 hours shooting 3 seconds of footage. And you'd be like, well, what is this? Am I a character? Am I just something that's dangling off the side of a lorry? You know, what is it? And it was unbelievably difficult. And I think when he finished shooting, Miller sort of went back to Australia and he brought with him 400 hours of footage. And his wife is the editor. Margaret Sixel is the editor, who is a genius. I genuinely think she's a genius. And in a sense, almost his co-director of these films. And she just went through it all. And it took her 3 months to sort out just the footage. And then you rebuild the film. And I think there was great tension in the fact that not only was it really hard to make and painful to make and physically dangerous to make, it was also, did they have a film at all? You know, did they have something they could put together? And it was there. The thing that was deep-rooted into Miller kind of was there, but it took them an awful long time to get to it and find it and sort of shape it.
Feels like hope.
I like this plan. We can start again. Just like the old days.
Look, it'll be a hard day. But I guarantee you that 160 days ride that way. There's nothing but salt. At least that way, you know, we might be able to. Together. Come across some kind of redemption.
I think that's fabulous in a way that, you know, the journey of that film is sort of about how you, it's like sculpture. It's shade, you know, it's shading and creating. You arrive at the block of marble, isn't it? And you see the statue of David in it, and you get that in a chaotic way. When you watch the film Fury Road, you know, while there are special effects and there are all sorts of elements to it that were enhanced, what you're watching is things they did. They are on the kind of the poles swinging back, the pole cats, that lorry, that juggernaut, you know, the tanker is going through the Namibian desert. Tom Hardy is on the bonnet. You know, all those things are true. And you can feel also within it the tension between the two actors kind of it's evoked in the two characters, and that is fascinating. So there is a great mirror, I think, between Fury Road and its creation and the film we watch.
Do you think we have reached the end of the Mad Max franchise, or will there be more Mad Max movies?
Well, I mean, this is sort of an industry sort of point, I suppose. Yeah, it's now known that Furiosa hasn't done very well at the box office. It hasn't done as well as Fury Road. It's kind of failed as a blockbuster. I mean, it's made money, but not to the level that maybe Warner Brothers would want. So I imagine they will be less encouraged to go back. Miller's now 80. So has he got another one in them? They are exhausting. And I think he needs a gap before he can go back into the desert again. He needs to kind of decompress after all that work. There was talk before Furiosa came out that he wanted to do The Wasteland, that the kind of Mad Max one. I think I would hope, and this is sort of me speculating, that if he went in with a sequel rather than a prequel and said, I can do, and maybe purified it a bit, maybe go back to the idea of a single chase and a film set on 2 days rather than 15 years, and get back to those principles of Max, maybe Warner Brothers would be interested and keen to do something with it. It's a good property, and Miller is a terrific director. So I hope they find a way to come back at it and to redo it, because I want more from it. But it's a business decision. You know, it's studio politics and all those things.
Yeah, could well be. Of course, Ian, every time we have you on the show, we always try to have a little fun before we go. This time, I am curious, if you were transported to the Mad Max universe, what would your Mad Maxian name be?
All right. Well, my Mad Max. They're always great, aren't they? I always feel like it's Gonzo Dickensian, the names. And they're all, in that way, they kind of describe what people do as well as how they look and what they're named. Mad Max is mad, in the internal way. So I suppose I would be a kind of scribe, because I am a writer, and I don't think I'd be at the forefront of the battle. So I'd probably have some insulting version of that, but I would probably be, this scribe fella Nathan. But they would, if Miller was doing it, he would add some kind of insult. Lanky Jim, scribe fella, he would do something like that, where you'll physically get insulted as well as you get your job. But I love all that. I love all those kind of names, and it's sort of, again, we right back to the first point we were talking about. It's very Australian. It's kind of nicknames. It's kind of Australian habit to do that. And I think it's a kind of real fun way of, you don't name the characters, you describe them.
Yeah, you got that right. Lanky Chain Scribe Fellow, thank you very much for joining us today. Congratulations on The Legend of Mad Max, the complete saga from Mad Max to Furiosa.
Thank you.
Ian Nathan is the author of The Legend of Mad Max, the complete saga from Mad Max to Furiosa. Find out more about Ian and his book at wpr.org/beta.
You're thinking of like you're mowing, and you're mowing in lines, and you're making a form or a shape, right? Like, today I'm going to do it square.
Coming up, Wisconsin author Holly Wilson talks about structuring her incredible new novel while mowing the lawn. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.